Hi, everybody. I'm an Al-Anon from Alabama, and my name's Bo Templin. Hey, I'm glad to be here with y'all. I'm glad y'all invited me to this celebration of gratitude. You know, for you people that maybe new or maybe not so new that haven't been to many of these things called conferences and conventions, what I want you to understand tonight, and I hope that you go away from here this weekend knowing beyond a shadow of a doubt, is that this weekend is just a celebration of recovery. That's what it's about. And I love the parties. Love coming to the parties. You'll find out as I tell you my story that's the way Shirley and I were introduced to this way of life, was at the party. I picked her up at a treatment center at 12 noon on Saturday of Labor Day weekend, 1982. And at 5 o'clock that afternoon, we were in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, on the campus of the university at the Tuscaloosa AA Al-Anon anniversary, yearly anniversary. And we walked into a room where there was 500 of y'all. And that was our introduction to this way of life. And I just stood back there and I looked, and I mean, y'all was cleaned up and you had on clean clothes and your hair was cut and you had on foo-foo juice and you was laughing and there was more hugging going on in that room to be no fighting than any place I'd ever been. And we fell in love with you that day, and that was Labor Day weekend 1982. This past Saturday, my wife celebrated 18 years of continuous sobriety. Thank you. And 1 month from today, September the 4th, my daughter Sissy and I will celebrate 18 years in Al-Anon. And I'll go ahead and tell you about the rest of the family. Our son-in-law, Bob, is celebrating his 9 years in Alcoholics Anonymous today. And we've got two beagles, and as quick as we can find an Alapup group, there you go. There it going. So thank you for inviting me to the party. I'm just so glad to be here, I'll tell you. This is not my first time to speak at a Georgia Al-Anon Alateen yearly convention. And I just got to tell you about the other one. Because it was several years ago. I'll tell you how long ago it was. Sissy's 31 now, and she spoke there that year as an Alateen. So it's been over that many years ago. And it was at Norman Park. And that's when the discussions that year were at their, discussions were at a high level about whether it should remain in Norman Park every year or whether it should be moved around. And there were a lot of discussions going on that weekend. And we went away from there and laughed all the way home about their area assemblies are just like ours. But I see that you got it squared away and you made some changes and here we are. And recovery goes on. It's good to see some old friends. It's always, always good to see some old friends. It's good to have the opportunity to make new friends. But let me tell you, most special, and I'll try to get through this without crying, but you'll find out I'm just a big old crier. My daughter explains that this way. She says, the more you cry, the less you pee. So I don't need to be stopping to go to the bathroom. But I am so thrilled to be here and get to spend another weekend of my life with my hero, Arbutus. I love you. I'll tell you. And I hope you people that are sitting in this room realize who your Saturday night speaker is. I won't go into that. She's going to tell her story. I'll just tell you this much. When they had that first World Service Convention and meeting in, what, 1961? There was 12 delegates from around the country. We didn't have areas and districts and all that that time. There was 12 delegates at that Al-Anon conference, and this lady was one of them. She was on Al-Anon Delegate Panel 1. Is that not fun? Now, that ain't the big deal. The big deal is that she's still coming. She's still here for me. But you see, I get to see her. We get to see each other a couple of times a year now, and I scare her into coming back every time I see her, because I remind her, if she quits coming, it's going to get turned over to people like me. So next thing, Arbutus is still there, real regular. So thank you for allowing me to be here. I do bring you greetings from Shirley and from Bob and from Sissy. And they would have loved to have been here, but there's other things, you know, in life, like work and having to show up and the paychecks and things. But today all is well out there on our little sober farm out there in West Blockton, Alabama. Three years ago, we moved out in the woods, and we left the big town and the big city of Hueytown. And we left the big city of 20,000 and moved out there. Well, I think it was about 782 when we're all there. And we're out there in God's country, and we're enjoying life. But it's not always been that way, and that's what we're going to talk about for a little while. A couple of other thank yous that I want to get out of the way before I tell you a little bit about me. I want to take just a minute, and I want to speak to some members of Alcoholics Anonymous that are sitting in this room tonight. And I know some of you, so I know that there's some members of AA sitting in this room. And what I want to do is I want to take just a minute or two and say to you, if you're a member of AA and you're sitting in this room, I just want to say thank you. Thank you from the bottom of my heart to Alcoholics Anonymous for a couple of reasons. Number one, thank you for being there 18 years ago when my gal reached out her hand. Because you see, I'd lost her. The bottle had her, and I couldn't do anything about it. I was driving myself crazy trying to find a way to get her sober and keep her sober. And I couldn't do it. And when she had that moment of clarity that I believe all recovering people have, I believe if you're an Al-Anon and you're in recovery, you had a moment of clarity. And when she had that moment of clarity, she reached out her hand to AA, and you had the hand of AA there for her. And you took her in, and you put your arms around her, and you loved her back to health. Because you see, she was dying of a fatal disease that we didn't even know she had. And you took her into your arms, and you put your arms around her, and you taught her how to live sober. And because of her getting involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and me getting involved in a program called Al-Anon, and two kids being introduced to a program called Al-Ateen, we was able to put that family back together. And because we were able to put that family back together, this past April, Shirley and I celebrated 36 years of marriage. And we couldn't have done it without you. But I want to thank Alcoholics Anonymous for another reason. I want to thank you for knowing from the very beginning that this thing called alcoholism is a family disease. And you see, I know that you knew it from the beginning because I'm one of them Al-Anons that believes in reading the textbook Alcoholics Anonymous. And I read and study your textbook on a regular basis. And it's there in your book that I learned that you knew that this was a family disease from the very beginning. And then, too, off to the side, I've asked Arbutus about that, and she's verified that. And if you've been taught the history, if you've got the kind of sponsors like I've had that insist that you learn the history of this thing, you find out that the first meetings were family meetings anyhow. But it's there in your book, you see. You dedicated two chapters of your book to the wives and to the family afterward. To us. And you let us know right then that you recognize that this is a family disease. And you had this 12-step program in place for us. And in 1951, when it was time for us to be born, and we stepped up and we said, can we have your 12 steps? You loved us enough that you threw your arms open to us. And you said, you bet you can. And here's what we want you to do, Bo. We want you to come on in, and we want you to learn how to implement these principles in your life. And we want you to learn how to live happy, joyous, and free. And it not be dependent on what another person does or does not do. And for that, I will be eternally grateful. And I say thank you to Alcoholics Anonymous. When I introduced myself to you tonight, I introduced myself as an Al-Anon. I've got to talk about that for just a minute. Because you see, when I got here 17 years and 11 months ago, I thought being married to a real live alcoholic made me an Al-Anon. What I found out is that being married to a real live alcoholic qualifies me for Al-Anon. It does not make me an Al-Anon. And there are several things that I do in my life today on a regular basis in order to tell you I'm a member of Al-Anon, and I want to share two or three of those with you. Number one, I go to Al-Anon meetings on a regular basis. I have a home group. My home group is the Wednesday night discussion group in Bessemer, Alabama. Now, my home group has three meetings a week. And one of them I can very rarely get to because it's a lunchtime meeting and I'm at work. The other two nighttime meetings I go to, Thursday nights I go fairly regularly, but Wednesday night is my home meeting. And if I'm not sick, if somebody else is not sick, if I'm in town, I feel like I have a responsibility to be there in my home group. And I go to Al-Anon meetings. Now, I know that there's more to this thing than just going to meetings. But I know that it starts with suiting up and showing up and occupying that chair. I know this is a program of action, and I know that you can't get it by osmosis. I know that because I tried. The first 7 months I was around this thing, I tried to rub up against you and get your recovery to rub off on me. And I wanted so bad what you had, but I didn't want to do what you said you had to do. But I just kept coming to those meetings, and I kept occupying that chair. It's kind of like, you know, I can take that chair, and I can take it out in the middle of the chicken coop, and I can set it down there, and I can occupy that chair in the middle of that chicken coop every day for 20 years. And guess what? Yeah, I still won't be a chicken. Yeah. But let me suggest this to you. If I occupy that chair in the middle of that chicken coop every day for 20 years, at the end of that time, I'm going to know a whole lot about chickens. Do you hear what I'm saying? It's suiting up and showing up and occupying that chair in that Al-Anon meeting with you old-timers, long-timers, seasoned veterans, with you people. It's there that I begin to get an idea of the changes I'm going to have to make if I want to be what you are when I grow up, if I want to learn to live the kind of life that you're living. So it starts with suiting up, showing up, and occupying that chair. Okay? Now, remember, this is just what worked for Bo. It's what made a difference for me. It's necessary for me today to tell you that I have a home group, and I've already talked a whole lot about my home group. But let me tell you how I feel about my home group. I feel like I belong to one of the two best home groups on the face of this earth. And my prayer for you today is that you belong to the other one. I hope you feel that. I hope you feel that way about your home group. But you see, this is what's so important to me about my home group. When I first got to Al-Anon in September 1982, I didn't need a home group. I first got here, I didn't need Al-Anon. There was nothing wrong with me. I got here well, and it took 7 months of me hanging around you for me to figure out just how sick I was and how much help I needed. But you see, when I got here, I told you there was nothing wrong with me, and I didn't need what you had. My wife was in the other room, and if she stayed sober, we'd be okay. Because you see, that treatment center my wife went through told her she had to go to 90 meetings in 90 days, and we did. Now, if you're an Al-Anon, you understand that. But I wasn't going for me. I was going to make sure that she was in that other meeting. Because the other thing I heard up there at that treatment center was, the ones that go to AA stay sober. I heard that. So I had a new role in life. My new job in life was to make sure she was in an AA meeting. Because if she stayed sober, we'd be okay. And we went to those 90 meetings in 90 days. And a lot of them were open speaker meetings. And we'd come right down here and we'd sit down close. I'd drag her down here so she could hear. And I'd sit there right beside her. And if that speaker said something that was important, I'd pop her with that elbow. Yeah. And, of course, I had to listen real close. Because we was going to have to discuss it on the way home, and she's still a little bit foggy in here. And I was going to have to explain a lot of stuff, and I knew that. But then the night came that we showed up there at the Bessemer group. And let me tell you alcoholics that are sitting in here in this room, y'all have got tunnel vision about several things. And one of the things y'all have tunnel vision about is closed meetings. And we showed up there at Bessemer one night, and it was a closed meeting. And they met me at the door and said, Bo, this is a closed meeting for alcoholics only. You can't. I said, you don't understand. My new job, I got to keep her. You don't understand. And they said, no, you don't understand. I said, you've been needing to turn her over to us for a while, and there's a meeting in that other room that you need to go to. And they directed me to the Al-Anon room. And so I eased off over there, and I walked in that room. And I wasn't being sponsored yet, you know, okay? I was still a part of what I heard just recently that made sense. I was part of the ISM, the ISM. I sponsor myself. Let me tell you, the first 7 months I was here, I sponsored me, and I had a fool for a sponsor. But I walked over there that night, and it was 2 minutes to eight. You see, the reason I say that about sponsors, my sponsors now tell me I have to be here 30 minutes early, prepared to stay till it's over. I can't show them anywhere in conference-approved literature where it says meetings last an hour. Until I can, I have to stay till it's over. Now, ain't bad deal. Show up 30 minutes early and stay till it's over. But that night I got to the door at 2 minutes to eight. Stopped and took a quick head count. 23 women. One other guy. He's sitting way down front. I went down there and got a seat by him, and we made it through the meeting that night, and we said the Lord's Prayer, and he turned around and introduced himself. And I introduced myself, and he said, "Yeah, I've been waiting on you." Say, I got an aunt and uncle. They're both at the big meeting now, but had an aunt and uncle that were real solid, solid members of Alcoholics Anonymous in that basement group, and they put the word out that we was on the way. And I looked at him, and I said, "Well, Kermit, I sure am glad there's one other guy here." He started laughing. He said, "Oh, I'm moving to Phoenix City in the morning." He said, "I was just hoping you'd get here and I'd meet you before I left town." And Kermit left town, and he turned them 23 women over to me. And, you know, I looked him in the eye, and I told him, I said, "I don't need what you have. There is nothing wrong with me. I am only here to make sure that Shirley's out there." And you know what those gals did? They throwed their arms around me, and they gave me a big old hug, and they smiled, and they said, "That's all right. You come right on in. We need you. We need you." And they began to very gently pull me into this thing without ever letting me know it. And let me tell you what they were pulling me in with. There are two or three things they pulled me in with. The first thing they pulled me in with was laughter. Remember the laughter when you first got here? Ain't that important? You bet it is. There hadn't been a whole lot of laughter in my life. That meeting, that first meeting that night, that was a speaker meeting, and we had one of our seasoned veterans that was sharing her story that night. And she got up there in front of the room after they got the meeting open and introduced herself. She said, "Hi, my name's Doris, and it's been 14 years since I had to plan a murder." And the whole room erupted. Everybody except me. I didn't laugh. I said, "No, I wouldn't have told that." Because, see, the truth was, I'd been planning that murder. You had, too. I didn't know that at the time. I was going to kill her and tell God she died. And I loved the laughter. I loved the laughter. The next thing that those gals used to pull me in there is they used hugs. We're a big hugging group. Our whole area over there believes in hugs. And they hugged me when I got there. They hugged me when I left. They hugged me when I didn't want to be hugged. And, well, let me explain it to you this way. This is the way they would do me. They put me a chair right by the back door of the room. If you ever come visit my home group, you'll see that you come in at the back of the room. And they put me a chair right back there by the door. And they said, "Bo, we know you don't want to be here. So this is your chair. And every night that you're here, this is your chair. And nobody else can occupy it. And you can sit in this chair." And I didn't have to go any further in the room than right there. And I'd go in there and I'd sit down and I'd occupy my chair and I'd listen to what y'all had to say. And then the meeting would be over. Now, them gals, they still won't admit it today, but I think they rotated on a monthly basis. They had a different woman assigned to me each month. And here's what she would do. See, when we stood up and held hands and said the Lord's Prayer, she'd make a move while everybody else had their eyes closed saying the Lord's Prayer. And in my group in Bessemer, I've been sponsored, and we sponsor each other over there. In that, the Lord's Prayer ends with the word "Amen." So we don't say anything after the word "Amen." When we say we're going to close the meeting with the Lord's Prayer, we say "Amen," and we drop our hands. And so I'd be standing there with my eyes closed, and we'd say "Amen," and I'd drop, and I'm right by the door, and I'd turn to go, and there she'd be between me and the door. How'd she get there? She moved, see? And her reason for being there was to give me that goodbye hug. And when she'd hug me, she'd whisper in my ear those magic words, "You keep coming back, Bo, because we need you." Well, I was going to be coming anyhow. I had to make sure, you know, Shirley was out there. I've been reading some of your literature. I didn't let you know that. And so I said, "Well, I believe I can. I can keep coming back, you see." And it kept me coming back until the miracle happened. Kept me coming back. Now, the other thing that they used to keep me coming back was that thing called unconditional love. I didn't understand that today. I'm not so sure I fully didn't understand it then. I'm not so sure I fully understand it today. But I'm getting a little better handle on it today. Those gals still just give and give and give, and they never ask for anything in return. What a deal. What a deal. And I was just sitting in there occupying their space. and turning them away. That's how sick I was, with that grin on my face telling you there was nothing wrong with me. Nothing wrong with me. Home group's real important to me today for another reason. See, I've been here long enough that some of the rewards are coming my way. Some of the benefits of living this way of life are happening to Bo. And it's there in my home group that I stand up to my responsibility for those good things. Because every time something good happens to me in this program, a responsibility comes with it. And so it's by showing up on a regular basis and making sure that I'm there for that newcomer and making sure that an Al-Anon meeting goes on. By participating financially, that's part of our recovery too, is to participate financially so that the bills can be paid and the literature can be bought and the Al-Anon meeting can go on. But most importantly, I'm there on business meetings so I can have my vote and my say in making sure that my home group stays within the traditions of Al-Anon. So that 18 years from now, Al-Anon's still going to be there. My challenge to you tonight is, what about you? Are you standing up to your responsibility for this thing that's been so freely given to us? The next thing I do in order to tell you I'm an Al-Anon is I have a sponsor. I think sponsor is the most talked about and least utilized thing in our fellowship today. Everybody says, get a sponsor, get a sponsor, get a sponsor. Most people think that means, a lot of people think that means get a phone number. I promise you, I know my sponsor's telephone number. But I've got sponsors that come out of the old school. They're old time. And so I've got sponsors that know my telephone number. And I hope you have that kind of sponsor too. Because when am I most likely not to call my sponsor? When I need to talk to them the worst. Is that not it? Is that not it? Yeah. Okay. So I believe in sponsorship. I believe in old time sponsorship. When it's time for me to get a sponsor there in Bessemer, there were no other male Al-Anons. So I picked a female to be my sponsor. Now let me tell you about her. She's old enough to be my mama. And she treats me like her son. And she came into Al-Anon in 1961. And she's a past delegate and she's raised me in service. About 3 months into this relationship, we knew I needed to talk to a man, so she was wise enough to send me out there in that AA room. Said, pick you a man out there that's working a good 12-step program. We'll make him part of this deal. I happened to pick the one that she'd been married to over 40 years at that time. And Jim is steeped in service, and he's a past delegate. And Jim and Fran have been my guides. They've been my sponsors. They've been the ones that have walked with me on this spiritual journey. And they both come out of the old school, and we'll talk a little bit more about what it means by coming out of the old school, but one thing it means is they don't sugarcoat it. They don't water it down. They tell you just like it is, and they tell you what you need to hear. The other thing is, Fran put a condition on it. She said, I'll be glad to sponsor you, Bo, but the only way I know to sponsor is in the steps. Now, if you're ready to make a commitment today to take these 12 spiritual principles and implement them in your life on a daily basis, then I'm ready to take you by the hand and walk with you. That's 17 years ago, and she's still walking with me today. Yeah, what a deal. What a deal. The last thing I do in order to tell you I'm an Al-Anon is I take those 12 spiritual principles, those 12 simple steps that we read tonight, 12 simple steps for a very complicated person, and to the best of my ability, I incorporate them in my life on a daily basis. Getting up each morning and doing a little bit of reading, having that quiet time, talking with God, asking God to come in and take control of my life on a daily basis. And going out there and putting one foot in front of the other and being the best Bo I can be today. Some days I do real good with that, especially days like today when I'm coming over here to be with you. And tomorrow will be a good day because I'm going to be surrounded by you. You know. But some days out there, it's not that easy, is it? And some days I don't do so good out there. But you know what? I'm beginning to realize it's not how good I do or I don't do that's that important. The important thing is, am I on the firing line? Am I making that commitment? And these are what I do today in order to tell you that I'm a member of Al-Anon. Let me tell you a little bit about me real quick and how I got here. In order to do that, I'll start with this simple statement. I was born at a very early age. Now, I don't think this is going to be a year-by-year thing. We haven't got enough time for that. But it's important that I tell you about that because, you see, I don't live very far today from where I was born. And I was born, and you people right in Georgia know about this. I was born right over there about 15 miles south of Birmingham in the middle of something called a Bible Belt. Y'all know about that. And I was born into a very strict, very religious Southern Baptist home. I don't know about spiritual, but we was religious. And we went to church Sunday morning and Sunday night on a real regular basis. And this went on through my mid-teens, late teens, till I left home. Now, what's important about this time is that it was there in that Southern Baptist church in Hueytown that I formed a concept of God that I brought into adulthood that caused me some problems. And it wasn't the church's fault. This was not the church. It was what I did. And for whatever reasons, the concept that I brought into adulthood was I had God sitting up there in that great white throne. And he had the big scoreboard and he had Bo's name on it. And he was real busy sitting up there judging and punishing Bo. Keeping tabs on Bo when he did something wrong, he even thought something wrong. Yeah. Y'all remember that? If he even think it? Yeah. And I was in trouble early on. And I had a very judging and a very punishing God. And that was a relationship I had with God many years later when I found the doors of Al-Anon. We'll talk about that more in a minute. Being raised in this strict religious home, I wasn't around any drinking, didn't know anything about drinking. Got involved in sports in school, wasn't around the drinking crowd. What I'm trying to say is I didn't drink. I met my wife, Shirley, in our mid-teens. And we started dating, and Shirley didn't drink. Now, she didn't drink for totally different reasons. She comes from that broken alcoholic home. But the deal is she didn't drink. So I didn't drink and she didn't drink. We met and we dated and we dated for 5 years and no drinking in our relationship. And we made a decision we could get along. And we set the date and we got married. And we set out on this thing called a great American dream. And we was just two kids. She was 19, I was 20. And we was madly in love. We knew that. We knew we loved each other. And we knew that we wanted to be successful in life. And what we thought success meant was material success. Everything that we had ever been taught everything that we remembered for some reason revolved around a dollar bill. We wanted the White House on the top of the hill with the picket fence. You know, the further up on the hill you lived and the bigger your house was and the whiter it was painted, you know, the more successful you were deemed to be, and that's what we wanted. And we set out on this great American dream, chasing the dollar to do that, and we was good at it. Shirley had a good job, and I had a good job. A year after we was married, we put that down payment on that first little house out there in Hueytown. You know what I'm talking about, the one in the track. You know, three little bitty bedrooms and a smaller bathroom. And a big, huge backyard with a chain-link fence for the kids. You know, and every other house looked just like. And we put the down payment on that thing, and we moved in, and we was off and running. 3.5 years after we was married, God gave us the most beautiful, blonde-headed, blue-eyed baby boy that a daddy could ever want. And Mike became a part of that great American dream. 17 months later, along came the most healthy, beautiful, brown-eyed baby girl, and Sissy became a part of that great American dream. And we sat down and took stock. We had two kids, we had two cars, we had a house, we had two jobs, and everything we had was mortgaged to the hilt. And we was happy, chasing that dollar. Shirley went back to work because we had to have the two paychecks. And it was when she went back to work after Sissy was born that she was asked to join the social sorority there in Bessemer, and she did. And it was at one of these sorority dances. You know the social sororities. All towns have them. And they do good work. You know, they do all kind of projects and things. And they were having a river party down on the Warrior River, not too far out of Hueytown where we were living. And it was late in the summer, and it was hot, and we were down on the Warrior River at these people's river house, and it was a gorgeous place, and the lights were down low, and the music is soft, and there's a gentle breeze blowing off that river, and the moon's reflecting down the water, and everything was just right. And I handed my wife the first drink of alcohol she ever had. And I said, "Here, honey, drink this." And it wasn't too many years down the road, she was right up in my face. And she, by the way, y'all know what it means when a speaker looks at his watch. Absolutely nothing. So it wasn't too many years down the road till Shirley was right up in my face and she was saying things like, "If you had never given me that drink, I wouldn't be the way I am today." Well, see, we didn't know anything about alcoholism. We didn't know that she had a fatal disease and that she was dying, and we didn't even know anything about it. What I knew was that mine and her relationship was changing, and not for the better. I knew that our family relationship was changing, and I knew our financial situation was changing. And I could trace the troubles back pretty close to the time that the drinking had started. And so what I did was I agreed with her. And I absolved her of any responsibility for anything that happened as a result of the drinking. And I took on a load of guilt that was to grow heavier and heavier and heavier as long as the drinking continued. And it almost got to be more than I could handle before I found the doors of Al-Anon. Now, I could stand up here the rest of the night and I could share war stories with you about our trip through active alcoholism. And I love war stories. Yeah. Some of you got a puzzled look, maybe you don't understand what war stories are. Let me tell you what war stories are. War stories are when we're sitting around before the meeting starts, you know, and we're having a cup of coffee and we're just talking. And I begin to tell you about cutting my little finger. And I didn't cut it bad. I cut it right there where it bends. And it would just bleed and bleed and bleed. And then just about the time I'd get the bleeding stopped, I'd forget and bend my finger again. And it'd start bleeding again. I'd tell you about how pesky it was. And Brookings is there with us, and he said, Bo, you're talking about a paper cut on your little finger. He said, son, and he holds up his hand, you know, same hand, same. He said, let me tell you, about 5 years before I retired at work, he said, I cut my little finger. He said it was so bad when he got through with it at the emergency room, it had 37 stitches in it. He said you couldn't even see the little finger. All you could see was stitches. Yeah. And then Charlie was sitting there with us here at the taping table. And Charles speaks up and said, y'all don't know anything. He said, let me tell you, same little finger several years ago, carrying in some of my taping equipment, and I dropped it, and it cut the finger off. And it grew back. That's what I'm talking about by war stories. The more you tell, the bigger they get. And I love war stories. I love them. But I found out something about war stories over the past few years. What I found out is that my war stories and your war stories are the same. They're the same. All the fingers are different. The hands are different. The times are different. The names are different. But you get all that out of the way, you know what's the same? The pain. That's what war stories are about. They're about pain. And my pain and your pain was pretty much just alike. So let me share with you two or three of the pains that I experienced as we walked through active alcoholism. First pain I share with you is that pain called guilt that I've already told you about. That was to grow heavier and heavier and heavier as long as the drinking continued. The next pain I share with you is a pain called anger. I don't know about you, but let me tell you about me. On a good day, I got up angry and went to bed angry. And on a bad day, I got up angry and I went to bed in a blind, running rage. And you see, I hadn't been raised that way, and I knew that life wasn't supposed to be lived that way. But as I looked around me, it seemed that everything that was happening to me was a legitimate cause for anger. And I couldn't find a way out. The next pain I'd share with you is a pain called resentment. And I didn't even know what resentment was till I got here and you taught me. But as I look back, I realized I was living my life full of resentment. Because you see, the time had now come that if you lived up the street from me and I saw you and your family out there in the yard cutting grass or cooking out or washing a car, if I saw you doing something together as a family out in the yard, I resented you. Because alcoholism had taken that away from us and we didn't do things out together anymore. If I saw you get in your car with your family and come by my house going somewhere together, I resented you. Because you see, alcoholism had taken that away from us. And we didn't go places together anymore. And of course, when you came by my house, if your car was nicer than mine, I resented you. Because alcoholism had taken the nice things. And we didn't have them anymore. The biggest resentment of all, I resented God. Because you see, God was punishing me through Shirley's drinking for giving her the first drink and setting this whole thing in motion. And my prayers had not stopped, but my prayers had become why me prayers. And how much more of this are you going to do to me, God? And I can't stand much more, God. How much longer is this going to last? And that was God when I got here to you people. The next pain I'd share with you is a pain that I hear alcoholics talk about a whole lot. And it's a pain called loneliness and isolation. And I believe you when you tell me that yours is a disease of loneliness and isolation. What I want you to know is you don't have a handle on that deal. I know about loneliness and isolation too. And it has very little to do with how many people are in the room. Some of the loneliest times of my life have been in crowded rooms, surrounded by people that were friends of mine at that time. And we would be sitting there. And they would be smiling and they would be laughing, genuinely having fun. And I would be sitting there with that smile that we used to have. You know the one that hurts your teeth? You know, the one where you have to grind. And I would be wanting to, so bad to say to them, how can y'all be happy? Y'all don't have the problems I have. Y'all hadn't got a drunk wife at home that you can't sober up. Maybe I should ask you if any of y'all know how to sober up a drunk wife. But I couldn't do that, you see. Because if I ask you to help me sober up my drunk wife, then I admitted to you that other pain that was consuming me. And that was a pain called failure. I'm the Southern dad. I'm the head of the house. I'm the father. And I'm supposed to be able to fix anything that happens, and I couldn't fix it. I could fix the things that happened as a result of it, but I couldn't fix her. And so I sat there, and I stuffed it, and I felt lonely, and I felt isolated. We know about loneliness and isolation. Yes, we do. This is the way we were living our lives in July 1982 out there in Hewittown. Me and Shirley and two teenage kids. Mike was 15 now and Sissy was 13. Four individuals living four separate lives under one roof. We had the curtains pulled and we didn't allow you in. Something happening over there. There's water coming from somewhere. In it. I don't know if it's going in that flower or coming out of that flower. But that's the way we were in that summer of July 1982, four individuals living four separate lives under one roof, and we had the curtains pulled. But we had that one big unwritten rule that every alcoholic family has. That rule is you don't talk about it. And what you had to do at our house right before you got ready to leave, right before you went out that front door, you stopped and you made sure everything was in place, including that false smile. And you hit the door and you told the world that we were fine. We were fine. Dying from a disease that we didn't even know we had. And it's late July 1982 and the kids and I are going to a softball game. And once again, we haven't asked Shirley to go. And that was okay with her because, you see, that would leave her at home for 4 or 5 hours by herself. And she could drink without us bothering her. Sissy and I are already in the car and we're waiting on Mike. He's running behind and I see Mike stop at the door and he talks to his mother for a minute and then he comes and gets in the car and he never says a word to me about that conversation. It was a couple of years later before I found out what went on in that conversation. But let me tell you, because I have Shirley's permission to tell you what about that conversation. As Mike was going out the door that night to get in the car, he stopped and looked at his mom and he said, Mom, we get home tonight, you're going to be passed out on the couch, passed out on the floor. Where are you going to be passed out, Mom? Because you see, that was Shirley's drinking pattern. She would drink until she, and wherever she passed out, then we either had to step over, pick her up, or do whatever we were going to do. And if Shirley was here tonight, she would tell you that for the very first time in Mike's life, she raised her hand to slap his teeth out. And as she raised her hand to slap his teeth out, the thought came into her mind, she said, about a vow she made to God many years before. The last time that her dad, in a drunken fit, beat her with the belt buckle end of a belt, she looked at her dad and she said, Dad, if I ever have kids, if God ever allows me to have kids, I'll never lay a hand on them. And here she was fixing to violate that vow that she had made to God, and she couldn't deny that it had something to do with drinking because she had a drink in this hand. And Mike didn't wait for an answer. He just came on and got in the car. When we got home that night, we knew something was different because Shirley wasn't passed out. And it was well past her passing out time. And the front door was open and she was waiting on us. And she had been drinking, but she wasn't drunk. And as we came in, she looked at me and she said, Bo, I've got to do something about my drinking. I can't go on living this way. And I've called a treatment center and I'm going into treatment. And I looked at her and reacted today like I know I was supposed to. With all the sarcasm I could muster, I looked at her. And I said, Shirley, this is number 1,382. What's different this time? There's another bounce check out there. You're in some kind of trouble somewhere. You're setting me up to come and rescue you one more time. And I told her I didn't believe her and took a shower and went to bed. And it was the next day when this treatment center called me for insurance information that I even believed her. Now let me tell you though, God was taking care of things. He was directing our lives right then. Because God sent us about 40 miles from Birmingham to a treatment center that believes wholeheartedly in treating this thing is a family disease. Bertha knows about this treatment center. Believes wholeheartedly in the 12-step programs of AA, Al-Anon, and Alateen. There was treatment centers in our area that didn't do it that way, and we didn't know the difference. God sent us there for a very short period of time to prepare us to turn the corner and walk into your arms where we've been ever since. I wish you could have seen us the day we took her off to treatment. I had a pickup truck. It's late July. It's hot. It's humid. The kids put two lawn chairs in the back of the pickup, two lounge chairs, had them a big blaster radio back there and a cooler full of Pepsi. And me and Shirley up front and off to treatment we go. You'd thought we was headed to the beach. We get up there and we get her checked in and we get ready to leave and this counselor comes over and stops us and he says, I just want to make you aware that we have something up here called Family Week. He said, and we'll be writing you a letter to tell you what the dates will be, but the kids being 13 and 15, both of them are old enough to come, and we want all three of you to come to Family Week. And he dismisses us, and we get in the truck, and we're headed back home, and the kids are up front with me, and they're saying, Dad, you know, we don't know about Family Week. They're out of school for summer vacation. They said, we checked that place out while you was checking her in, and said, they ain't got a swimming pool. And I said, all kids don't worry about it. We're not going up there. There's nothing wrong with us. But through a series of circumstances that came about, we did make the decision to go up there. And we moved in up there on a Monday, and we stayed until Friday. Now, they call that thing Family Week. Let me tell you, it's misnamed. It's Hell Week. That's what I call it, because that's what it was. But it was the beginning for me. It was the beginning of the change. The first thing that happened when I got up there on the very first day is they started telling me that my wife has a disease, and it's a disease called alcoholism. And since she has a disease, I am not responsible for her having that disease. Well, I needed to hear that. They said, since it's a disease, Bo, there's three C's that you need to learn about, the three C's from Eleanor. You didn't cause it, you can't control it, and you can't cure it. Well, I knew I couldn't control and cure it. I'd darn near kill myself trying. What I needed to hear was I didn't cause it, because you know what I took up there with me? Yeah, I took that load of guilt. And it was up there that I could begin the process of shedding that load of guilt that had become. Now, I just began the process up there. I finished that in Eleanor. Yeah. I said, your wife has got a disease, and you're not responsible for her having it. Let me tell you what I've been learning the last 17 years, 11 months in Al-Anon. Since it's a disease and I'm not responsible for her having it, then I no longer need to try to be responsible for her recovery from it. And I've been able to release my wife and her recovery to the God of her understanding. And you know what that's done for me? It's freed up a whole lot of precious time and energy for Bo to work on Bo. Yeah, for me to work on me. The next thing they told me up there, next thing that happened up there was important. They had a lady come up there, and she brought us an Al-Anon meeting up there. There was 18 of us people up there, me and Mike and Sissy and 15 other people. The other 15 we didn't know. They were representing other patients. But all 18 of us had to go to that meeting that night. My sponsor won't let me count that as my starting in Al-Anon because I was forced to go. So we went to that Al-Anon meeting that night, and I've still got vivid memories of that meeting. And I don't know what that lady did with the other 17 people in that room. Because my remembrance of that meeting is that she pointed her finger and she talked directly to me. She said, Bo. Now, I know she probably didn't, but that's the way I remember it. And you see, God was being good to me again, because where'd she come from? The old school. The old school. We don't water it down, and we don't sugarcoat it. We tell you just like it is. And she said, Bo, when your wife gets out of this treatment center, if she's going to stay sober, she's going to go to AA, period. Now, if you want to regain any of your sanity and begin to experience any serenity, then you're going to go to Al-Anon, period. Now, I hope you do. All right, I'm here to encourage you to. She just looked at me and said, big boy, if you want what we got, then this is where you're going to go. This is where you'll get it. And then she threw the kicker in right then. She said, and by the way, if you're going to be any kind of daddy at all, you're going to make sure those two precious kids are introduced to Alateen. Where was the oldest and strongest Alateen group in the state of Alabama at that time? Bessemer Al-Anon Family Group. Right where we were headed. Already in place there waiting for us. Yeah. So we got out of Dodge Bullets and got out of Hell Week. We waited on Shirley to get out of treatment and picked her up like I told you, and we went to Tuscaloosa to that Al-Anon AA anniversary. Let me tell you, folks, it was years before I realized just what God did for the Templins that night. This was 1982, Labor Day weekend. And the Al-Anons in Tuscaloosa, Alabama had a male Al-Anon speaker and a female AA speaker. I can't tell you today. I do not know who he was. I don't remember his name. I don't even remember where he was from. I can tell you who that female AA speaker was. I can tell you where she lives today because we stay in contact with her. I can still tell you most of her story. Now that tells you where I was that night. I was not there about me. You see. But God continued to put those things out there for me. We got home from that thing that night. Shirley had not been home in 38 nights. And we got home from that anniversary that night about 1 o'clock in the morning. We sat down in the middle of the den floor. And me and Shirley and two kids with a bag of chocolate chip cookies and a gallon of milk. And we sat there till almost daylight talking about family recovery. And we made a conscious commitment and a decision as a family to give this thing called family recovery our best shot. And that decision so far has led to me being right here with you in Columbus, Georgia tonight. What a ride it has been. What a ride. We asked the kids to go to 4 Alateen meetings, one a week for 4 weeks, and then we would talk with them. They went to their 4 meetings. Mike, 15 years old, blonde-headed, blue-eyed, had a motorcycle. Mike looked at his mom and said, "It ain't for me, Mom." So I just can't sit in there and talk about things like that. Said, "I love you and I want you to stay sober. And I'll go to those meetings when you get one of those chips and they have cakes. And of course, if y'all go to a convention down at Fort Walton or Destin or Panama City, I'll go to that. But I can't go to those meetings every Tuesday night." And that was okay. But let me tell you something about Mike. Mike lived a 12-step program in his life. He did not claim to be a member of Alateen, but Mike lived 12 steps in his life. And the only way I know to explain that to you, if you lived in active alcoholism, you're affected. If you live in active recovery where the principles are practiced, you will be affected. Yeah. Sissy went to her 4 meetings. She fell in love with it. Couldn't drag her away. She was 13 years old. She stayed in Alateen till she was 20. She came right on into Al-Anon. She's 31 years old today. She's still an active member of Al-Anon. She's a 31-year-old young lady with 18 years of 12-step recovery. And I thank God and Alateen for that every day. I want to thank Alateen for raising my daughter. Because let me tell you something. 2 years after she was in Alateen, she was able to share with us that she was contemplating suicide. The summer her mama went into treatment. And the best me and Shirley could do is we missed it all. And Alateen raised my daughter. I'm convinced of this. If I'm not convinced of anything else, I'm convinced of this. Alateen sponsors have a special place in heaven. God has a special garden for them. I believe that. Now, after Sissy got out of Alateen, she was in college when she came out of Alateen into Al-Anon, and she was going to college about 50 miles away from home. And for 2 years while she was in college, she drove that 50 miles one way back home every Tuesday night to sponsor that Alateen group that she was raised in, giving back what had been given to her. Yeah. Shirley was in AA. She was absolutely serious about her recovery. She had a sponsor, she had a book, and she was growing spiritually. Bo was flopping around in your rooms, and I was doing nothing, and the gap between us was getting wider. In recovery, the gap between us was getting wider. And it took 7 months of this, and then finally one night I looked at my wife, and I said, "Tell me what you're doing." And she shared with me about her sponsor, and she shared with me about her God, and she shared with me about her spiritual program of action. And I went back to Bessemer the next night, and I asked Fran to be my sponsor, and I began that night a program of spiritual growth that is continuing today. Continuing today. We got involved in these steps, and then Jim became a part of this thing, and Jim and Fran and I got involved in this, and we're just moving right along, and things are getting better. And it's time for me to, I think, it's time for me to do an inventory, and I start trying to do an inventory, and I can't get it done. And so I holler, you know how you do. You do it, try to do it your way, and it don't work, and then you holler at your sponsor. That's the way I've always done it. So I called, and Jim and friends said, well, come on by. And I went by that day and sat down at the table with them, and I said, look, I'm trying to do an inventory, and I'm having all kind of trouble. And Fran looked at me, and she said, Bo, if you're trying to do an inventory, you got to be having trouble. I said, Fran, where do you get all this wisdom? 30 seconds ago, you knew nothing about this. She said, it's real simple, Bo. If you're trying to do the fourth step, you're in trouble because you ain't through with the third step. Yeah. I said, we're going to go back to the third step. You're going to have to do something about your concept of God. And that's when my AA buddy Jim reached out and took me by the hand. See, God knew how sick I was. He knew I was going to need the best of both programs. And Jim reached out and took me by the hand and literally took me into the other room. And we sat down at his desk with a big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he took me into the chapter to the agnostic. And that's where I found the God that I have today. A God of infinite power and of infinite love. Available to me 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. And I got it right out of the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous in the chapter to the agnostic. And so I've got this new concept of God, and I said, well, I'm off and running now, but I wasn't. I continued to fight God because, see, back there in that Southern Baptist church, you know the one I'm talking about. When you gave it to God, you know, you might end up being a missionary to Africa. At the least, you was going to be a Sunday school teacher. And that was valid with me, and I continued to fight God because that was not what I wanted to do. And God worked with me then just like he works with me today. He let me get just as miserable as I had to get. And finally, I got miserable enough. And I looked at Shirley one day, and I said, Shirley, can you help me with this? I said, I don't like me. And she told me right quick she couldn't help me. And I called my sponsor, and she said, I can't help you with that. She said, that's between you and God. And I finally decided, that was a Wednesday morning that I was feeling that way, and I finally decided I'd go on to work. I could be miserable there and get paid for it. And I pulled off the side of the road that Wednesday morning at 8:05, halfway to work there in Bessemer, Alabama. And I sat there on the side of that road and I beat on that steering wheel. And I did what I know today was my version of the third step prayer. I couldn't say the third step prayer. I didn't know it at that time. But what I said was, God, I don't know what I got that you can use. And I don't know where we're going to have to go to use it. And I don't know what we're going to have to do to make sure it's put to use. But whatever it is and wherever it is, God, let's get it on. I can't fight you anymore. And I surrendered. I surrendered. And there was no flash of light, and but I felt a sense of ease, just a sense of ease. And as I look back today, what I realized what I did that Wednesday morning was I fired Bo as the general manager of Bo's life. And I hired the best general managers available, and that's God. And my biggest job since that Wednesday morning till tonight right here, my biggest job has been to keep Bo fired and God hired. And as long as I can do that, this thing goes just the way it's supposed to go. Let me tell you something, folks. There's power. There's power in these programs of ours. There's power in these rooms when we gather like we're gathering tonight. And I'm fixing to share some of that with you. Because you see, it doesn't all go along the broad highway. It's not all peaches and cream. We continued to move along and work in our programs, and our family got better. Until the big deal, May 17th, 1988, when three policemen knocked on our door and told us our 20-year-old son had been killed by a drunk driver. And you see, here we are almost 6 years in a program of recovery, and boom, out of all things, a drunk driver. And this is thrown right in our face. Now, I'm not here tonight to dwell on that fact. What I'm here tonight to do is to share with you what happened as a result of that. To bring you the good news of the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, Al-Anon, and Al-Ateen. Because let me tell you what happened in our life. Within 45 minutes of us getting the message of Mike's death, AA and Al-Anon was in our home. And you came in our home. The church came, yeah. And they brought the fried chicken and the tater salad and they left. The rest of the family came. They were tired. They were grieving. They left. Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon came and you did something totally different. You stayed. You stayed. 24 hours a day, as long as it took. And you came in the door saying, we don't understand this either. We're not here with answers. Don't misconstrue this thing. We're not here with answers. We're here because we got open arms and soft shoulders and big hearts, and we love you, and we want to help you, and we want to love you through this thing if you will allow us to do it. That's what you did. And you sat down and you made decisions for us because we wasn't capable of making those decisions. And you made good decisions. You made good decisions. The female AAs at Bessemer Group made up a schedule of 3-hour shifts, 24 hours a day. Every 3 hours there was a different recovering female showed up at our door, and her only job was don't let her out of your sight, don't let her do something she wouldn't want to do, and love her to death. And I don't know anywhere else you get that on the face of the earth, except rooms like this full of people just like you. My son was killed at 9 o'clock on a Tuesday night, 9 o'clock on a Wednesday night in our front yard, 15 Alateens sitting out there Indian-legged with arms around each other's shoulders in a circle of love. With my daughter in the center of that circle, just loving her, just loving her. Had some Al-Anons come up to me and look at me and said, we need to talk to you in another room. And I went in another room and there was an AA in there waiting on me. He looked at me and he said, tell me where it is. I said, where are you? He said, tell me where it is. I said, standing right over in the closet. And he went over and he got the shotgun and he unloaded it and he took it home with him. He kept me from doing something totally insane. That was already being mapped out in this crazy mind of mine. My simple mind is not capable of comprehending the power that's involved in these programs. 12 steps on a wall is 12 steps on a wall. 12 steps in a book is 12 steps in a book. 12 steps in action is something to behold. Something to behold. I'm telling you, people. We're here. We're right where we ought to be. Everything that we need is right here with each other. We began to walk through that and we began to get a little better. Sissy fell in love. I've already told you today's Bob's 9th AA birthday. He did not come into her life riding the great white steed. He came into her life astride the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. He had about 4.5 years of good, solid 12-step recovery at that time. They decided they wanted to get married in the same church that Shirley and I had gotten married in so many years ago. So we set all that up. The counselor that we had in Family Week that had become a part of our life and stayed in touch with us was an ordained Methodist minister. Howard said, nobody else will marry them but us, but me, Howard Collins. Said, nobody will marry that pair but me. So we went out there to the Southern Baptist Church with a Methodist preacher. And he wore a Catholic robe that he got somewhere. And we had us a program wedding. We opened it with a Serenity Prayer. And we closed it with the Lord's Prayer. And the only thing that Shirley absolutely refused to let me do, and I've still got a resentment about it today, she refused to let me pass the basket. We had a good crowd there. So Bob and Sissy got married and moved into a townhouse, and we was living out there in Hewittown with the big house and the swimming pool and all this kind of stuff, and people quit coming to our house. So we looked at Bob and Sissy and we said, well, yeah, we're going to sell the house. And I've always wanted to live in the woods. So I said, we called them over one Sunday and said, we're going to sell the house and we're moving to the woods. Well, that's as far as we had planned this thing. And we put a for sale sign in the yard and a couple come by and said, if you can get out, we'll take it. Didn't even argue the price. It was in the school district they needed to be in and they could afford it. I said, but we need to move. So Charlotte and I put all our furniture and everything in storage. And for 93 days, we lived in a businessman's motel room. The one with a little bitty kitchenette over there. If you want to work on your relationship, folks. We'd invite Bob and Sissy over to visit us, and they'd bring 2 folding chairs and sit on the sidewalk outside the door. Oh, but it was a fun time, but we were determined that we wanted to find what we wanted Yeah, well, and we found it. We're land barons now. We found us 2 acres out in the woods. That's all we wanted. And we went and bought us 2 manufactured homes. But Bob and Sissy had said, y'all can't go without us. And so we bought 2 of them at one time, put one up on top of the hill. It's just a gentle slope. Me and Shirley's got a place up on top of the hill, and about 2/3 of the way down the hill, Bob and Sissy got their place. Bob's last name's Country, so Sissy's Bob and Sissy Country. So I was up in Minnesota a while back, and some folks brought me a sign that they had made us for our fence that says Templin Country. And those that know will know. And we moved out there, and we've got deer, and we got little varmints, and we got rabbits, and we got squirrels. And we got 2 beagle puppies that are a spiritual experience in themselves. And we're just before organizing the first Allopup group in our area, because they both qualify. And we get out there, and life is settling back down, and things are going pretty good. And then a year ago, June, the other shoe drops. Shirley and I were over in Mississippi for a day of fun at one of those places that they have in Mississippi. And we had just gotten over there to this casino and walked in, and we hadn't been there 15 minutes, and they're paging Bo and Shirley Templin to come to the security office. And you know, if you hadn't done anything wrong, you know something's wrong. And we go in there, and there's a phone number for us to call, and we call. And it's a gal that Sissy sponsors, answers the phone, and she says, you need to come back home. Sissy's just found out that she's got an aneurysm on her brain. 30 years old, and an aneurysm on her brain. And all the way home, it's a 3-hour drive, and all the way home, I hollered at God again. And finally, about halfway home, Shirley looked at me and said, Bo, would you please let me drive? And I got out of the seat and let her drive, and I continued to holler at God. And as it has turned out, it has been one of the most spiritual experiences. And I just got to share some of it with you, because you got to know how this thing works. We got home, my daughter looked at me and she said, Dad, I've talked to God about this and it's going to be okay. But I wasn't okay. 2 days later, my wife sat me down. She said, Bo, you've got to do something. You are an absolute nervous wreck. And God's going to take care of this. Sissy's going to be okay. Sissy asked me to go see the brain surgeon. You see, there's no treatment for an aneurysm except surgery, brain surgery. And it's not something that you say, let's wait and see how it gets. It's something you do. Okay? We had 6 days between finding out and surgery. Sissy asked me to go see the brain surgeon with her. She thought that would make me feel better. And we walked in his office, and she showed me this plaque that was sitting in his office. And the plaque says, this practice believes in spiritual healing, and if you do not adhere to these principles, we suggest you find another doctor. We found the only brain surgeon in the state of Alabama that didn't think he was God. And we went in and we had a talk with the doctor, and the doctor says, Sissy, I know you're checking me out, and Dad, I know you're checking me out, but Sissy, we don't take everybody here that comes in. I want to check you out. She said, ask me anything, doctor. My life's an open book. He said, tell me about your relationship with God. And I'm still a nervous wreck. You know how the surgery went with that kind of deal. Picture perfect. The doctor had a resentment that he didn't. He said, I almost asked Shirley if I could video this because he works in a teaching hospital. He said, and I should have, because this one was just like the textbook. Just like the text. They even identified a problem while he was in there that can be treated with medication that they think is going to totally clear up her migraines. Yeah. And they're already seeing progress in there. He operated on her on Tuesday morning, sent her home on Saturday morning, said he had never done that before in his life. And he looked at her and he said, but you're well. He said, you just got to go home and heal. You are well. Yeah. Wednesday night up there, when he came out of ICU, you know, that was mandatory to keep her in there for a day or two. He came out of ICU and came by the waiting room. And there was 30 people in that waiting room for Sissy. And one of them had showed up with 4 big old pizzas. And we was all out there in the waiting room having a pizza party, and he dropped by to have pizza. And she's well. She's well. God took care of that. About 2 weeks after surgery, when she's home, and I'm still trying to figure out what was it about me. What was it? And about 2 weeks after she's home, I get home from work one day, and my wife says, your daughter wrote us a letter. She had some things she wanted to say to us, and she just couldn't talk to us, so she wrote us a letter. And Shirley said, I've already read it, and she said, you better sit down so you can read it. And I sat down and I read the letter, and she had some, you know, she talked to her mom some about some things. And then she got to my part, and she said, Dad, she said, I want to thank you for being my dad. She said, Dad, I want to thank you for having the God that you have in your life. And I want to thank you for loving me enough to share that God with me. And I want to thank you for being there for me and for you and your God for being there for me during this. And it was clear as could be. See, what had been going on with me was, how do you make an amend to a grown daughter for not taking her to church and allowing her to have a God when she was growing up? In an alcoholic home, sometimes you don't go to church and take your kids to church. And Sissy had never been exposed to religion, and she had never had an opportunity. And I was trying to figure out, how can I go back and make an amend for that? Because I felt responsible for that. And then I get the letter, and I realize the amend has been made. And then once again, God is taking care of it. God is taking care of it. So that's where we are today. Sissy's hair has grown back. She's an absolutely gorgeous gal. And I think the biggest problem she had was having her head shaved. And she became a cap person. And but life now is good. We're back on the hill, and life is like it should be, and things are going on. And we continue today to go to a lot of meetings, to be around you as much as we can. Because you see, God is the center of my life today. But I have never, ever seen God directly. God speaks to me on a real regular basis. And when God speaks to me, it looks and sounds a whole lot like you. It really does. So you see, you are vital to my recovery. I can't do this without you. So now that you know a little bit about us and about our recovery and about me, and you know how important you are to me and how vital you are in my recovery, I want to close this thing by making this deal with you. And I made this deal with some folks in this room, so I know it works. Here's the deal. I'm going to keep coming back. Rooms like this full of folks just like you. Now, your part of the deal is I want you to keep coming back. Rooms like this full of folks just like us. Now, if I keep coming back and you keep coming back, then one day, maybe somewhere, one day down the road, our paths will cross again as we trudge this road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then. Thanks for having me.